Anthony Thomas, councillor, ready to proceed?
May it please the court, for the record, my name is Lynn Nessner, attorney registration 39209. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Anthony Thomas. If there's any time left at the end, I would like to reserve it for rebuttal. The primary issue before this court is whether the police had adequate justification to support their warrantless seizure and search of Mr. Thomas. But moreover, we're dealing with the fundamental right of every person to be able to walk down the street, public street, with whomever they choose without being harassed by the police. In this case, Mr. Thomas was walking down the street with two individuals in broad daylight on the sidewalk around 1:45 in the afternoon. They weren't committing any crimes. The police testified numerous times on the record that they did not observe this group commit any crime. Unfortunately for Mr. Thomas, the police recognized one of the individuals he was walking with and knew that she had a criminal history which included prostitution. Being familiar with her, they ran her name through their computer and found there was an existing warrant for her arrest.
What was the warrant for?
The police officer testified it was a misdemeanor warrant. They didn't know if it was affiliated with prostitution.
So the record is silent as to what exactly the outstanding warrant was for?
The police officer said it was a misdemeanor warrant. They didn't know if it was related to prostitution. So, yes. Unfortunately, because Mr. Thomas was walking with this person who had a criminal history, he also became someone that the police could search. When they pulled over to arrest Ms. Evans, they blocked this group's path and surrounded them. There were two officers, they had badges, and they were armed, and they came out and began arresting Ms. Evans, and Mr. Thomas started to walk away. He didn't run, he didn't flee, he just started to walk away because this arrest did not concern him. It was at this point that one of the officers said, "Sir, can you step over here for a minute?" At this point, Mr. Thomas heeded the police officer's command and returned to the police officer, and he immediately searched him.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just had a question. Is this a consensual encounter?
Well, the people have argued for the first time on appeal that this is a consensual encounter. Now, this argument fails for two reasons. First, the district attorney did not raise this argument below. The district court, the defense counsel, district attorney, everyone treated it as an investigatory stop. Implicit in the district court's findings is that it was a seizure, an investigatory stop. So because the people waived this argument below, pursuant to People v. Salazar, a Colorado Supreme Court case, they're barred from raising it now on appeal for the first time. Secondly, if this court chooses to address this issue on the merits for the first time on appeal, their argument also fails because it was not a consensual encounter. There's a reason why all the parties below treated it as an investigatory stop. The police outnumbered Mr. Thomas. They twice intercepted his direction of travel. They were armed. They had badges. He had just witnessed them arrest one of his acquaintances. No reasonable person would have felt free to ignore the police officer's command to come back here. Because it was an investigatory stop, the Fourth Amendment is implicated, which means the police need to be able to articulate a specific basis in fact for believing that Mr. Thomas, not one of his associates, but Mr. Thomas was committing a specific crime. Here they didn't really have that. What they had was a man walking with a woman who they recognized had been arrested previously for prostitution. They did not have indications of prostitution. For example, they didn't see an exchange of money. They did not see her lead him to a car, as they testified was their MO. They testified prostitutes typically do not walk down the street with their clients. There was nothing indicative that this was a prostitute with her client. I mean, it wasn't dark, they weren't in a secluded area, the police did not testify that she was wearing promiscuous clothing. I mean, they had no more reason to believe that he was her client than her brother or her boyfriend or her husband. I mean, even prostitutes are allowed to have friends. So the problem here is that all the police had was speculation. and that is not enough under the Fourth Amendment. And it's speculation based on association. That's not enough either. In U.S. v. Davis, the Tenth Circuit said that even having a criminal record isn't enough to necessarily create a reasonable suspicion. And here, the police didn't know if he had a criminal record. He just knew he was walking with someone with a criminal record. The district court also erred in relying on the incidence of crime in the area. The Supreme Court has said on several occasions, such as in Outlaw v. People and People v. Greer, that this is just one factor to be considered. It's not dispositive. Just because there is crime in an area doesn't mean that everyone in that area loses their rights or that their rights are suspended. Because the police did not have a reasonable suspicion, they did not articulate such, we would ask that this court reverse Mr. Thomas's conviction. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Of approximately 9 minutes.
This is my first oral argument. Okay, well then, can I still do that?
You can reserve all 9 minutes if you want.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Catherine Hansen appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. Registration number 25464. Analyzing a suppression claim often involves several layers of consideration. Question first is whether there's a seizure, and if so, when did it occur? The second question often involves what type of seizure occurred. And then the third often question that comes up is, once we have a seizure and we can identify the type of seizure, other facts justifying the police conduct in this case. So I think the first step, looking at the first step basically is, was there a seizure in this case? And if so, when did it occur? And it's the people's position that the seizure occurred at the moment at which the defendant was pat down. Basically, you have two officers that were driving in the area. They did not block the path of the defendant and the two other individuals that were walking. I think the testimony from the officer, Detective Fox, was that they saw the Miss Evans, they ran her name for a warrant, they saw that she had a warrant, so they drove up, Detective Fox drove up into an alley that was in the direction of where they were walking, got out of her car and went back around the corner to where they were walking. So there's nothing like we have an outlaw where the police use their vehicles to alter the defendant's course of travel.
So was this consensual?
Yes, this was consensual up until the point of the pat-down.
You would agree the DA at trial at the motions hearing did not address consensual stop at all?
Yes, I agree. They did not address it. They did not concede it, however.
How is that not a waiver?
Well, I think there's the court in Moody recognized the distinction, I believe in a footnote, recognized the distinction between the case like in Stiegeld where they made affirmative factual assertions, affirmative concessions that there was no standing. The court in Moody recognized there's a difference between that and mere failure to argue. And I believe they cited a case and said, but it's unnecessary that they acknowledge that this is a distinction, this is a legitimate distinction. But they also acknowledge that the language in Stiegeld said, we may not choose to address arguments even when they're conceded below. So I think Moody makes it clear what you need to have is you need to have a fully developed factual record. And in Arness, we argued for the first, personally that was my case, we argued for the first time in the Supreme Court exigent circumstances. And the court in Arness specifically acknowledged that when there's a factually developed record, the court, the reviewing court, whether it's this court or the Supreme Court, can address a suppression argument made for the first time in appeal.
But how can we say this is fully developed?
Because we have an undisputed testimony about what happened. We don't have a factual dispute. What we have.
But the officer, well, let's go through the facts then. The officers testified that they had a police identification. I believe it was a hat
Right.
Or some clear identification, I'm a police officer.
Right, and I believe Ms. Evans knew they were police officers, knew them personally.
And they had a gun?
They had a weapon. There's no indication that it was visible. In fact, the testimony...
Okay, but how do we have a factual record if we don't know if it's visible?
Because we have testimony that the only thing that was visible showing that they were officers was the word police on their hat and their badge.
And it's your position if a police officer says to a citizen who's walking in the opposite direction, come over here?
I don't believe that's what he said, Your Honor. I believe what he said is, sir, can you come over here? I'd like to talk to you. And the case law is very clear that officers can walk up to anyone on the street and ask to talk to them. They can come up and ask criminal-related questions, investigatory questions. That doesn't render the situation a seizure. What we have is the officer, and this was undisputed testimony, sir, can you come over here for a minute so I can talk to you? The defendant actually started to walk over and said, why? And the officer said, I just want to talk to you about what you're doing with this woman, or something to that effect. And so pretty soon, I think almost immediately after that, he said, I'm going to pat you down for weapons for officer safety. So I would agree that at the point at which he pat him down, I'm not arguing that that was a consensual or volunteered search or frisk, but at that point, a reasonable person would have not felt free to leave.
Okay, but, well, what's the difference then between whether the seizure occurs when the officer announces his intent to pat Mr. Thomas down, or if the seizure occurs a couple minutes earlier when the officer says, come over here? Because as I read the record, there's nothing that happened between those two events that would enhance the level of suspicion.
You're absolutely correct.
So it doesn't matter. Then
nope.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Then move on.
Okay. I just think it's important to have the character, the circumstances properly characterized. But yes, I would agree that nothing happened in between that would provide further support to justify the seizure. So that's what the first test is usually, whether there's a seizure and whether at what point that occurred. Then you look at the type of seizure. And what we have here, we have actually two types of seizures here. They can be justified on one of two grounds. And the first was what I argued in my brief, which is a protective search for weapons. In the courts, several courts, Hardwick, Mascarena, several courts have recognized that there is a type of seizure that's not investigating particularly a stop and frisk. It's not, it is a seizure, it is a detention, but it's not investigating for a crime. It's justified for officer safety reasons. And I think you had that in Mascarenas, you had that in Hardrick. We don't have a lot of cases. In doing the research for this case, most cases, stop and frisk cases, deal with ones that occur during a valid investigatory stop for a crime. So the analysis usually is what crime are they suspecting. But the courts have recognized a stop and frisk purely for officer safety reasons. And
even
that's
in the absence of a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity?
Yes. Yes.
That's what you're saying Hardwick says.
Hardwick and Mascarenas. I think if you look at Sutherland, and I think if you look at all the cases, Pennsylvania versus Mims, Maryland versus Williams, all the cases that talk about when you're doing an investigatory stop, you can order people out of a car, the passengers out of a car, without independent reasonable suspicion. You have situations like...
But don't those cases include the fact that the stop of the car was based on a reasonable suspicion?
Yes, but
here they're walking down the street, and what was the reasonable suspicion? Miss Evans was on a warrant. What was the reasonable suspicion as to Mr. Thomas?
Well, that's the second part of my argument. There was reasonable suspicion to stop him for a crime, but this first I'm talking about is a separate detention for officer safety purposes. And I think if you look at the cases, while they're certainly not factually the same, the cases of ordering passengers out of car, of when you're executing a search warrant at someone's house, Mueller versus Mena, where you're executing a search warrant at someone's house, you're allowed to detain the people inside. And what they do is they talk about, under the Fourth Amendment, the touchstone is reasonableness. So there are some circumstances in which you balance the government interest with the intrusion itself on the person you're analyzing the seizure and determine whether it's reasonable. And that's the analysis that generally comes into play when you're talking about doing frisks of individuals that were not the direct target of criminal activity.
So two people are walking down the street, the officers want to talk to one and they say to the other, I want to search you for weapons before I talk to your friend. You're saying that's supported by Harvard?
Well, I mean, yes, but that's not what happened here, actually. They were arresting her simultaneous with asking him if they can talk to him, and for officer safety reasons, as the court recognized, and the trial court made these findings, the nature of the area, the type of crime involved that she's often involved with, the type of crime that's often involved in the area, and the extensive experience of the officers finding weapons, knives on these people that they encounter in this area. I think if you look at the Mack case, which Mack dealt with reasonable suspicion first, which I'm arguing did occur here as to the prostitution, but I'm just talking first as to the officer safety reasons. When addressing whether there was reasonable suspicion to believe that the person they were dealing with was armed and dangerous, which is the same standard if you're doing a pat down during the course of a regular investigatory stop, you can look at the nature of the area. In fact, they talk about the defendant's action of putting his hand behind his back, the officer's awareness that the area was known for criminal activity, and the officer's personal experience of arresting people in that area and having weapons on them consistently, that was enough to justify reasonable suspicion that the person was armed and dangerous just to do a pat-down frisk.
But in Mack, there was a furtive gesture.
There was a putting his hand behind his back. I mean, I think what we have here is a slight furtive gesture. I think the defendant, upon seeing the police, started to walk away. These were three people that were walking together. And I agree that it's certainly not flight, but I believe it is something that should be considered, especially in fact of the officer's testimony that when he encounters someone who is engaged in prostitution and three people, or when he has a group of people walking away, from his experience, when they split up, even if they don't run, hide, whatever, hide their hands, from his experience, that often indicated that they were together involved in criminal activity.
Does Mr. Thomas have a constitutional right to walk away at least until the officer either asks or instructs him to do otherwise?
Yes.
And how can his exercise of that constitutional right become a circumstance that works against him in terms of supporting an involuntary seizure in the form of a Terry stop?
Well, perhaps this is where the distinction between when the consensual encounter occurred, because I believe he voluntarily walked over to the officer when he said, can I talk to you about what's going on here?
Well, if his walking away from the officer was voluntary and his turning around and walking back toward the officer was voluntary, doesn't that dissipate any suspicion that would have been engendered by his walking away in the first place?
No, I don't believe so. I believe you still have the same circumstances. You have the association. This person is walking down the street in an area known for significant prostitution activity. I mean, lots of criminals, people that are about to engage in criminal activity, voluntarily choose to engage with the police. Doesn't mean it's smart, but it happens. And so basically what you had at the moment, even before they contacted these people, is the observations of these three people walking in an area known for prostitution with a known prostitute who had a warrant out for her arrest, and the area that they were walking in was consistent with some of the areas described by the police officers that prostitutions often engage in their business. There was an alley. Obviously, the officer parked right in the alley right there. There were businesses up ahead. There were motels ahead. And so under these circumstances, again, this is one of these situations where we can't pick in isolation the high crime area, her criminal history, these kind of things, and say individually that's enough to justify either the pat down or an investigatory stop in this case. But put together, I think they justify the officer's concern for his safety once the defendant chose to come back and talk with him, as they were simultaneously arresting this person's companion. And I think in Hampe versus Timpton, that was a case, I believe it's cited in one of the cases, that talked about one of the factors. In fact, I think the court talked about one of the factors is what's going on, whether the companion is being arrested. In fact, I think the court specifically made a finding that that was further support for reasonable suspicion for officer safety concerns.
I guess what concerns me is there's an implication of guilt by association. I mean, if Joe Nacio is walking down 17th Street with one of his corporate lawyers, does that association with a known felon subject his attorney to being stopped and frisked?
In and of itself, of course not.
If they were walking in a high crime area, would it?
Well, all these factors add up together. No, not in that, because the type of criminal conduct that he is alleged or proven to have been engaged in is not soliciting themselves for sex on the street in that exact area and in that those exact circumstances. So I think certainly this is not just simply three people walking down the street and the officers walking up. We have numerous circumstances suggesting that there may have been solicitation for prostitution going on. But again,
what specific circumstances, other than Mr. Thomas's presence with a known prostitute, is indicative of solicitation?
The area.
And?
And the officer's experience in when the contact, the people that are engaged in solicitation for prostitution and police arrive, they often split up into separate directions. There was testimony of that. I think you have all kinds of the circumstance, the context in which these three people were walking down the street is important. It's not just three people walking down the street. It's a known prostitute with a warrant out for her arrest. It's two men with her. They're walking in an area of which prostitution occurs on a very, very frequent basis.
Go ahead.
That's okay. I believe I talked about the factors in my brief, and I do believe they support either the seizure for personal safety or for investigation of prostitution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to come back to the issue of whether it was a consensual encounter. And I think the one police officer did, in fact, block their path and intercept the direction of travel on page 16 of the suppression hearing. Now, this act in itself maybe wasn't enough to show authority, but then there was another cop, so you have two cops that outnumber Mr. Thomas. You know, they're armed, they have badges, they are obviously police officers, and Mr. Thomas made his desire to walk away known. I mean, he made his desire to walk away and avoid police contact obvious, and they hauled him back. And whether you say, come over here, or can you please come over here, I think is semantics, because you have an armed police officer, you know, directing a citizen to return.
Is the record clear as to whether the officer's weapons were observable to Mr. Thomas?
It is not. They just said they were armed. I don't believe they went into the issue, which is more of why this court should not address the consensual encounter on appeal for the first time, because the defense didn't have an opportunity to question the police officers about the circumstances that would go to the issue of consent. I mean, the district court did not make findings on the issue either, although implicit in the district court's findings is that it was a seizure and that the Fourth Amendment was implicated. And I do think that People v. Salazar, the Colorado Supreme Court case, is very analogous and controls the situation as to whether the people can raise this issue for the first time on appeal.
Well, let me ask this. If it was consensual and now he's standing next to an officer, is it reasonable for the officer to be concerned, given the nature of the area, the knives that they testified they saw all the time in the area? Is it reasonable for the officer to say, I'm going to pat you down to make sure I'm safe since you're now standing next to me.
I mean, the police officer called him over. If the police officer was concerned for his safety, why not let Mr. Thomas walk away? He called Mr. Thomas back to question him about why he was hanging out with a prostitute. I mean,
but that's why I'm saying, if that was consensual, if Mr. Thomas voluntarily said, I'll come and talk to you, officer, if it was consensual, was it,
well,
at
then,
that point, is the officer justified?
Well, I mean, my argument is that the officer needed a reasonable suspicion to call him back, that as soon as he said, hey, get back here, that was the seizure. That's when the seizure began. But assuming that it was consensual and he chose to walk back, as soon as he patted him down, I mean, for...
Well, then he's right near him, right? He's within
He needs arms. More than... He needs a reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Thomas was armed and dangerous. He didn't really have that, besides the fact that the area was known for crime. I mean,
and that's the outlaw opinion that talks about
that. That's insufficient. It's not enough. They needed some reason to believe that Mr. Thomas, you know, had a gun somewhere on his body, or if he was wearing a bulky jacket. But there's nothing beyond, well, you know, we know people in this area carry knives, or, you know, there's a lot of criminals in this area. But that's not enough.
Well, in Mac, they seem to have found, according to the people, that officer safety justified the pat down. What do you say about the application of the Mac case to this case?
I would say that that Outlaw and Davis are more similar. I can't talk to Mac. I haven't said it exactly. But here, I mean, there needs to be more. There needs to be a suggestion that someone's armed and dangerous. Under Terry, I mean, you have your initial, like, when you see someone, there needs to be a reasonable suspicion that a crime has occurred. You know, the officers testified numerous times on the record that they didn't observe any crime. And when asked directly, you know, did you have a reasonable suspicion there? Yes. Did you suspect that Mr. Thomas had committed or was about to commit a crime? I wouldn't say I would suspect that. I mean, they couldn't even, at the suppression hearing, they didn't even testify that they had a reasonable suspicion. I mean, did you suspect that he had committed or was about to commit a crime? In essence, he testified no. He said, we know Miss Evans is into those kind of things, so I guess there was a little suspicion on why he would be hanging around with a prostitute. They were curious why he'd be hanging around with a prostitute. We don't even know if Mr. Thomas knew that she was a prostitute. I mean, the slippery slope that this case creates is, I mean, a complete erosion of the Fourth Amendment, where, you know, you could be in the vicinity of a criminal, not even knowing that they have a criminal history, but if the police recognize them as a criminal, then, you know, you're subject to a search. I mean, in the Nacho example, you know, 5 points is close to Lodo. Let's say he was walking in 5 points. Is now the combination of the fact that he has a criminal history and they're in 5 points, and I mean, this isn't sufficient. I mean, what you need is specific facts that would indicate prostitution or solicitation was occurring, and that's what's absent here. I mean, there was an exchange of money. There wasn't, like, any behavior that was consistent with, I mean, they were familiar with this woman. They were familiar with what she did with her clients, was take them into cars. They didn't follow this group to see if she was going to take him to a hotel or take him to the, you know, to a car or take him in the alley. I mean, they weren't even investigating prostitution. They were just executing a warrant for an arrest that we don't even know is related to prostitution. And because he was there with her in the vicinity, now he gets searched because there's crime in the area? I mean, the police need more than that. That's what the Fourth Amendment requires, and there's a reason why we have the Fourth Amendment, to, like, protect against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Well, there was testimony here that it was known that people in this area carry knives, I think one of the officers said.
But that's not particular to Mr. Thomas. I mean, again, that's a whole, like, reputation of the locality. I mean, they need something that ties a weapon to Mr. Thomas. They need something that ties...
What I'm getting at is, before they make the arrest of this Miss Evans, and this guy's with her, and they know that people in the area carry knives, is it reasonable to pat the person down, look for a weapon, which is, I think, what the people are suggesting? Or is it impermissible to do that?
I think it's impermissible. I think they need more than a reputation or like a hunch or a speculation. That's a speculation. Well, we think, you know, every person in this area carries knives, so
but
we're going to...
You suggested if he was wearing a bulky jacket, or I think you made some other suggestions, then that might justify a pat.
I'm suggesting if they had testified at the suppression hearing, that they saw something that, like, gave them, you know, a basis to believe that he was carrying a weapon, that then they could search him. But under the people's rationale...
Will they ask that question?
What?
Will they ask that question?
I'm not sure that that was developed. I mean, I think what they relied on when they were asked, you know, why did you search him, was, well, you know, people in this area carry weapons. And it was based on the locality. But
nothing specific to Mr. Thomas.
Nothing specific to Mr. Thomas. And the problem with the people's argument is that then, you know, everyone in that area, like, their rights are suspended. Then everyone becomes subject to a protective frisk. Any person that they would invite over to talk to them or command to talk to them, I mean, any person that they would stop on the street, then they could do a protective frisk. And that's not acceptable. I mean, that's not what Terry and Stone require.
Thank you. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused. We will take another